Chapter 11. Cornerstone. My painting teacher in high school would always tell me, when painting from life, to never use the colors black or white out of the tube directly, especially not black. "You may think you see something pure white or pure black," he would say, "but it's usually an illusion. Learning to paint is learning to see the subtle variations of color, to see gradual shades and forms, where others see flat colors and outlines." In order to break up with Anna, I needed to stop painting everything in my life as black and white. She was not good or evil. She was not loving or abusive. She was both, and she was hurting me. Something that was blocking me from writing this book was a fear of being honest. There are different types of honesty, of course. You can tell the facts of the matter while twisting the truth. Sometimes fiction is more truthful than reality. Perhaps I am afraid of people seeing me as I am, imperfect, or seeing people I still love and seeing their imperfections as well. Can you write truthfully and still be loving? Will it carry? Maybe sometimes the honesty is more loving. It depends how you cut it. I've certainly cut with words while being true to the facts, but not to the whole. There is always another side. I don't hide much anymore. For years, I lied compulsively about everything. What street I walked on as I walked home. Who I was texting. Compulsively encircling myself in lies, harmless and white, large and small. Creating a confusing labyrinth that I always secretly hoped someone would penetrate. Tylenol tells some part of our body's defenses to turn off. It turns down the fever, the pain, the loneliness. I remember lying in bed with a doctor, a client, who was prestigious for whatever reason. He kept telling me that I needed someone to dominate me, to be a real man I could trust. I laughed him off. In a more vulnerable moment, he admitted that he often had patients in the ER who were alive until they fixed them. The minute we get their blood pressure to a reasonable place, their fever down, everything to a normal range, they die. There's an idea of homeostasis, a natural return to the baseline, but not everyone can be at their baseline all the time. Obviously, a runner's heart shouldn't be at a resting rate while they run. Why should someone's heart be at baseline when they're experiencing psychological trauma? We are still learning about ourselves, in the individual sense and the larger humanity sense. We don't know why we do things. Now we think it's better not to hit children. Maybe in the past it made sense. The world was more dangerous. Maybe now it gives us a disproportionate sense of fear. We have access to so many resources. We could all be fed, clothed, housed in comfort, and still have plenty. Why aren't we? Is it a logistics problem? Is it a psychological one? The choices we are presented with are rarely the binaries we make them out to be. There are endless paths branching out. Perhaps it's easier to simplify, to try to find a right and a wrong. Perhaps it's all fine. Perhaps we're just trying our best. Perhaps sometimes, though, we've fallen so off course that we are justifying our harm to others in a profoundly destructive way. Finding that balance is hard. We are bombarded with information, but we always have been. I think about how so many of the vibrant colors we see every day were not always so available. It's easy to see a vibrant purple shirt, but back in Rome, it was a costly luxury to see that vibrant purple, reserved and hidden away. Vibrant and dangerous paints, slowly killing the artist who used them. Was it perhaps just as harmful for the artist not to paint? How do you weigh these costs? Our couples therapy became more fraught. As I grew better at setting boundaries in other areas of my life, I began to set them with Anna, too. She did not take them well. I told Anna I needed her to stop arguing with me about sex. She said okay, but she didn't follow through. If I said no to any of her advances, she would tell me I didn't care about her. So I told her to stop initiating sex with me altogether. She pouted, was angry, petulant. She would press herself against me and hump me, beg for it. One couples therapy session, I talked about how I was losing hope for the relationship. You just need to be more patient, the therapist said. I sat up straight. Be more patient? I asked, an edge in my voice. Anna is trying her best, the therapist said. Anna shook her head. I think she's tired of being patient with me. She feels like she's been patient for a long time. I looked at the therapist, mouth agape. Are you really asking me to be more patient about being sexually assaulted? Something shifted in me after that. I talked about it with my own therapist. That was definitely inappropriate for her to say, my therapist told me, one of the only times she had said something so firmly. The couple's therapist had reached out to my therapist to speak with her. Do you want me to? She asked. I will say I find it to be an unusual request. No, I said, putting my hands firmly on my thighs. Thank you. I understand why the couple's therapist was so defensive of Anna. She is very lovable, and she makes herself so vulnerable. Often, I would hold her at night and tell her I saw her as this pure, lovely heart, like an egg yolk, tender and delicate, something to be protected. And she would nestle into my arms like a child. There is something very beautiful about someone who is capable of being vulnerable like that. But she weaponized her pain against me. She saw that I couldn't bear to see her cry. I don't think she did it with malicious intent, but she needed to control the situation. Her crippling anxiety was all pervasive. She was terrified of the world. She had been through so much. It's not my story to tell, but I know why she felt that way. I hoped that as I learned how to express my boundaries, that she would learn and heal with me, but she didn't. As I became able to see the situation with a calm, removed perspective, she grew even more emotional. For months, I tried to save the relationship. I loved her. I kept putting up new boundaries, giving myself more space, hoping she would see what I was doing and learn that if she wanted to be in my life, she had to respect me. But she didn't. In many ways, the worst part of being financially abused was how Anna spent the money. It felt all the more humiliating that so much of the money I earned went on buying comic books, toy figurines, and video games. One month, she spent over $10,000 on comic books alone. I couldn't understand how she spent so much money. I was so patient with her. She told me she was afraid I would yell at her. I talked with her like she was a child, said we would fix it, and asked her not to do it again. But of course, she did it again. One day, when I saw she had spent nearly $3,000 on comic books in one night, I broke down crying. She said it wasn't that bad, we had enough to cover it. I asked her, how many hours did I have to be in pain for this money? How much did I have to bleed? She told me she spent so much money because she felt unappreciated for her work. She claimed she was working harder than me and felt unappreciated. I had a friend, when I told her this story years after we broke up, interrupt me here, angrily shouting, "What work did she do? She sat in the house your pussy bought, smoking weed, answering emails, jerking off, looking at Reddit and your photos." I would cry and ask why a comic book or a video game was more important to her than my health. She would say it was her mental illness. She lost control. I would be so overwhelmed that I would vomit, shaking and crying. At the end of our marriage, I had almost nothing left in my savings compared to what I had earned, what I had hoped to save. Anna blew it all, spending money like water falling through her fingers. I was so humiliated that I didn't tell any of my friends for a long time. I was lucky I was still able to work. When I left, I did it in parts. First, I moved to New York. I'd been miserable for a long time in San Francisco. It is a complete monoculture. Almost everything there is for people who had made their fortune in tech. The food, the art, the parties. And everything that wasn't designed to suit their needs was rapidly being priced out. I missed New York, I missed the Met, I missed the lit scene. I missed the warehouse parties with good techno. I missed the subway and the parks and how people totally ignored you on the street. I missed my high school friends and my family. Anna used to tell me that if I moved to New York, our relationship was over. Well, I was finally done with the relationship. I told her I needed to make the move. I couldn't make myself miserable for a partner who valued the relationship more than my happiness. She was distraught. She begged me to just be long distance. I confided in a friend that I thought we would break up before the year was over. More than anything else, I was terrified of living alone. I love being around people. I love cooking and cleaning with them, watching a show, going out and doing whatever together. I found being alone surprisingly comfortable. I was so much better at taking care of myself. I made myself breakfast in the morning and dinner at night. I would walk to Pilates and enjoy the brisk winter weather. The only time I was really lonely was after dark. This is when I began to understand why some people watch TV every night. It gives you a sense of some human interaction. On nights that I didn't hang out with friends, I would watch a show. I could finally watch whatever I was interested in. Such freedom. I still missed Anna, on some level. We would text still, have phone calls. But I felt confident I had made the right decision. I knew I needed to be in the city. It was so wonderful being able to see all my old friends. Through it all, I tried to remain friends with Anna. I told her I didn't want to have sex anymore, but that I still loved her. A friend told me that whenever Anna would talk to him, she would talk about winning me back. She was a hot mess. She told me she was suicidal. She sent me photos of her cutting herself until I told her to stop. She wanted to sell the house. She said she felt like she had no friends in San Francisco. I asked if she wanted to move out to New York. Maybe I could introduce her to some of my friends. She ended up moving into my apartment. I'd convinced myself that she would be able to respect my boundaries, but she wasn't. I ended up regressing, feeling deeply distressed, anxious, overwhelmed. We would have blowout fights almost constantly. I ended up moving out, letting her keep the apartment and all the furniture I had bought for it. I couldn't deal with her anymore. Getting space helped. She told me money was hard, so I paid for the lease, for the utilities. I made sure she had food and everything she needed. She kept answering my emails for me. In so many ways, I was lucky to be able to leave Anna so easily. Of course, there were psychological and legal ties between us, but financially, I was independent. Sex work allowed me to leave her. I learned the lesson very young that I had to be financially independent or risk losing all my power. My grandmother, on my mother's side, ran and owned an independent business. I only realized this recently. For a long time, I thought the family business was my grandfather's. She was always intense and my siblings were scared of her, but I loved her dearly. She was an incredible baker and her home was always impeccable. She would give me books on postmodern decoration and taught me how to sew. Her company was an educational video production company. They sold videos to help people learn about basic subjects or prep for tests like the SATs. Obviously, our industries are different, but I feel a connection to the work I do producing adult videos and my grandmother's work. Producing videos of any kind is no small feat. My mother, on the other hand, was a stay-at-home mom. My grandmother was very cruel to her from the stories my father told me. He told me my grandmother apologized to him after he married my mother. She said my mother was too lazy to ever be a proper wife, and my grandmother felt she had failed in raising her. My father told me this story, intending to insult my mother and make me think she was lazy too. Later, I found out the reason she was lazy was because she was sick. She had a thyroid disorder. I recently asked my mother why she had never gotten a divorce from my father. Well, she said, I can't afford to get a place with enough bedrooms for all you kids to visit. He just keeps to himself and plays his video games. It's not too bad. I always knew that having my own money could keep me safe. I never wanted to rely on any one man for my safety. The thought terrified me. I had seen people get into relationships with men they thought were wonderful and loving, who slowly became more awful and abusive. But it was too late for them. They were housewives with multiple children. How could they leave? How could they get through the social stigma? How could they support themselves and their children? While sex work is a way for queer people and women to reclaim some amount of power from the patriarchy, it's certainly not the only way. Usually, all you have to do is look at whatever fundamentalist Christians are championing as political policy and run in the opposite direction. Abortion, and really birth control of any kind, is a big one. Abusive men frequently use reproductive coercion to maintain power over women. It's one thing to leave a relationship when you have no support structure. It's another to leave a relationship when you have kids. Most women don't want to leave their children behind, and it's painfully hard to be a single mother, especially in America. That's why abortion is such a touchy subject. That's why some states want to require the father to have a say in whether or not a pregnancy can be aborted. That's why birth control pills are stigmatized as well. They give women autonomy in their relationships. Unlike condoms, which can be removed or tampered with easily, birth control can often be taken in private. Getting your tubes tied is another powerful way for women to reclaim their reproductive autonomy. Yet some doctors will not allow it without permission of the husband, or they'll say someone isn't old enough to have the procedure done. Divorce is something Christians hate, but it can be an incredibly powerful tool for women who need to escape. In states that allowed no-fault divorces, intimate partner violence dropped dramatically. Mutual aid is incredibly important as well. I've let countless people getting out of bad situations crash in my guest room, no questions asked. Sometimes they aren't even someone I know personally, just a friend of a friend. Queer kids who needed a break from their family, people with black eyes I don't ask too many questions about. When I was young, people would do the same for me. A guest room is nice, but for many, cash is even better. GoFundMe, Venmo, and other apps that allow you to send money directly to someone in need are critically important. Even if you live halfway across the world, you can make sure someone has enough food for their next meal and a room for the night, whatever it is they need in that moment. When I finally filed to get a divorce from Anna, I was surprised at the intensity of the shame and guilt that filled me. I thought I had shed the skin of Christianity, but I hadn't. I wanted to be in a faithful, loving marriage, queer as though it might be. I wanted to work through all the hardship and the pain as a team, as partners. I felt like I was committing a sin. It's interesting what stuck from my religious upbringing. I don't feel ashamed of being a sex worker, nor am I ashamed that I enjoy it, which I think would disgust many of the people at the church of my youth. In some ways, I must admit, the sinfulness of it all is part of the enjoyment. The act of transgression is a thrill, as is teaching my clients to fully embrace their sexuality, to learn how to transmute that shame and disgust into potent pleasure. My therapist used to tell me to trust and listen to my body. If something gives me pleasure and does not harm anyone, then it is fine. If something brings up pain, I need to sit with that pain and listen to why it hurts. I am sure many people would hate sex work, just as many people would probably hate being a mortician. I can't imagine most people enjoying handling a dead body, filling it with preservatives, painting the face to look appealing to the still living. Yet, many of my friends of gothic inclinations love their job preparing bodies after death. I think our culture is strange for its tendency to condemn anything we personally would not enjoy. We condemn others for getting abortions or for having too many kids, for landscaping decisions policed by absurd housing associations, for getting tattoos or dressing too preppy. I cannot, for the life of me, understand the desire to tell someone else that they must live their life in a certain way, especially for decisions that cause no harm to others. I spend a great deal of time thinking about why a woman or queer person literally owning and profiting from their sexual labor is so inherently threatening to the patriarchy. Who from the patriarchy actually benefits, ultimately? I reread Bell Hooks' All About Love. She talks about how real love happens more easily when both parties are entering into a relationship with total freedom to walk away at any time. How many women in heterosexual relationships, especially in America, desperately wish they could leave their husband, but cannot because their husband provides access to food, shelter, and medical insurance? How many men oppose abortion rights, equal wages, and other anti-discriminatory policies because on some level they realize this would give the women in their lives the ability to sustain themselves and be fully independent? What about women's unpaid labor around their homes, estimated to be collectively worth $10 trillion? I don't think you can look at the numbers and deny that, overall, men have far greater economic freedom than women. Of course, it makes sense to me that women who are fully dependent on their husbands detest the idea of sex work. It literally moves their money, i.e., money they've earned doing unpaid labor around the house, to a sex worker. This sex worker, usually a woman or a queer person, is usually not dependent on any single man to support them. They can maintain relationships with a multitude of clients, placing less weight on every relationship individually. This is an enviable position, because, in theory at least, they can walk away and not lose everything. It is easier for them to maintain boundaries. They don't need to rely on any one client for 100% of their income, so if someone does something that makes them uncomfortable, they can address it directly. If the person fails to listen, they can walk away from the relationship without losing their home or any other support networks they've built up, because their entire life is not built around one other person. People love to discuss with great angst the ever-rising divorce rate. I like to point out that whenever states passed laws allowing no-fault divorces, the homicide rate against women dropped dramatically. Forcing women to stay in marriage is literally putting people's lives on the line. So is linking marriage to access to health care. It's obviously much easier to break up with someone if your ability to have food, shelter, and other basic necessities of life are not tied to maintaining a relationship with them. Men benefit materially from this, of course, but I do think it is deeply psychologically wounding. I'm not sure anyone escapes the harm perpetuated by these dynamics. Men are faced with the overwhelming responsibility of being the provider, of showing no emotion besides anger, no vulnerabilities. Most men are trained not to cry from a young age. Often, my favorite clients are the ones with deep wounds who need a healing touch. I have had some who, when I first met them, would flinch whenever I touched them. The ones who, perhaps, never had a chance to lose their virginity, or who were hit as children, so their brains equate touch with pain. I like to hold them, gently caress them, and teach them about the types of touch that can bring pleasure. So many of my clients need a space to not be men. They need a space where someone else takes the lead, who guides them through the process. I can't tell you how many men have come to me telling me they have a challenging time getting hard and difficulties orgasming. Then when we get down to it, they are trying to micromanage a situation, telling me to do this position or that. I put my finger to their mouth and tell them that right now They need to let the professional handle things. That I know what I'm doing, and that right now, they need to be in their body, not in their mind and in their mouth. To lie back, relax, and let me take care of them. To only speak if something hurts or feels uncomfortable. And to just let things feel good. They're often surprised at how their body responds when they let themselves trust someone. I think perhaps because I've made that journey myself, it's easier for me to guide them through it. I've been privileged in my work to coax tears out of those who haven't cried in decades. It's painful to watch, gut-wrenching, the desire to cry and the fear of rejection fighting on someone's face. I've spent so much time rubbing backs, cooing, reassuring people that it's okay to cry, teaching them what it means to be soothed, not hit. Not every sex worker approaches their work this way. Many prefer to make their job more about the physical labor instead of the emotional labor. They minimize conversations with clients, preferring to keep it all sexual. Client comes through the door, hands over money, they fuck, he comes, he showers, he leaves. Sometimes their bookings can be over in 15 minutes or less. It's like changing the oil in a car. For me, the physical aspect is far less interesting than the emotional. I market myself in an attempt to entice clients who want to talk, to be cared for, to work through something. It makes the work fulfilling, something I can look back on and smile. It is, however, far more work. After an emotionally taxing client, I usually need to take the rest of the day off. It's intense. After I broke up with Anna, I stopped feeling that same sort of intense and stabbing pain I used to while being penetrated during sex. It feels strange to be in a space where I can walk away. I can say no. I can fire a client without having to justify it to Anna anymore. The funny thing is, even my clients like my attitude better. Those who've known me over the years remark that I'm glowing, that I seem so happy. Even now, I feel this unshakable sense of a weight being lifted. That a part of the pain in my shoulders, passed down from my mother to me, is simply gone. While we were negotiating our divorce, she demanded 10% of my income, as quote-unquote residuals, for the rest of my life. I laughed in disbelief. She told me that a lawyer had told her she was entitled to it. At the time, I was almost 24. The rest of my life was, theoretically, a long time. We had been married for around 4 years. She claimed she made me, that she wrote everything and designed anything that was ever worthwhile by me, that she was the one who created my connections, that if not for her, my friends would hate me. Hearing everything she was saying made me sick to my stomach. She sounded exactly like those asshole photographers she used to always talk shit about. When that didn't make me stay, she said I was abandoning her, that if I wouldn't promise to take care of her financially, she would soon be homeless and starving on the streets. I asked her why she wouldn't go back to working in tech, where she was making a comfortable 6 figures. Why did I have to take care of her when she was nearly a decade older than me? She sent me messages so harsh they made me sick. I stopped speaking to her for a while after that.